You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education podcast reflecting on the THE World Academic Summit, which was held at University of California, Berkeley from the 26th to the 28th of September. I'm Chris Havergal and I'm joined by editor John Gill, rankings editor Phil Beatty and reporter Ellie Bothwell. This year's summit was on the theme of world-class universities and the public good. And there's certainly no better place to be discussing this than in California. I'd just like to sort of start by sort of asking people sort of what sort of reflections they had on that theme, looking back on the summit.
Yeah, I mean, I think my reflection over the course of the 2 or 3 days that we were there and, you know, had this incredible group of presidents and Nobel Prize winners and Silicon Valley entrepreneurs in the room together is that there are really big problems that are specific to the state university system in the US in terms of, you know, public universities, the funding, the governance structures, the lack of sort of agency, as it was described at the event, this feeling that the public no longer are willing to sort of invest in universities, or the elected government are no longer willing to invest on the public's behalf. And this shift of sort of the funding of university to the individual, and there was a lot of concern about that and what it means for the ethos of higher education, especially on a campus like Berkeley, which, you know, takes tens of thousands of students, far more than its private sort of compatriots like Stanford just down the road, you know, far more on Pell Grants, which are the sort of disadvantaged students, and have this really crucial role in the US. But I think beyond that, you know, there were obviously a lot of discussions about US-specific problems, but it was a much broader discussion, actually. We had, for example, the Vice-Chancellor of Cambridge there talking about the need for world-class universities to contribute to the public good, not just locally and nationally, but globally. And how does that translate into sort of our feeling as taxpayers that support universities in terms of, are we getting bang for the buck, and are we sort of, you know, willing to carry on supporting universities? So really fascinating discussion. I think although there was a certain amount of soul searching and angst, if you like, the overall feeling that I come away from is one of optimism. You know, a lot of people in the room from a lot of different walks of life, many of them very high powered in different ways, but all really feeling that the public good remains a crucial part of a university's DNA, crucial to society, crucial to the world. And I think overall my feeling was very optimistic. I don't know about the others that were there.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it felt like it was a difficult, challenging session because across all the world people were saying there's no votes in investing in universities, the debate has shifted towards private beneficiaries of higher education rather than the public. Mm-hmm. It was a universal challenge. You know, we had rectors in Germany, rectors, of course, presidents and vice-chancellors in Britain, all sharing these messages, Australia. But yeah, it was ultimately a celebration. It was a reassertion of the incredible role universities play, you know, from fighting diseases and making the kind of seismic breakthroughs that are required to take humanity forward, as well as educating young people. So it's very positive. The challenge is this: how do we sell this to the general public and politicians? Mm-hmm. There's pressure across the world on the public purse. How do we make the case to say, on pure economic terms, you invest in universities and university teaching, you will get it back through enhanced democracy, as well as through the actual tax dollars coming back to you from a highly skilled society, you'll get it back through innovation. How do we sell that to governments and politicians? How do we make people believe and see this data? And that was the only thing that still left me grasping for something. It seems so self-evident, but how do we actually build that case sell it?
In terms of the session, one of the things that the sessions I really enjoyed was Reid Hoffman, who's the co-founder of LinkedIn.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, stupendously wealthy individual, incredibly creative, and, you know, I can't remember exactly, but he's sort of the 100th richest person in the world or something.
Yeah, definitely.
And he was there. I would say, just as an aside, it was fascinating to chat to him. And as the two of us were being mic'd up for a session, I noticed that he was wearing a sort of cotton trader's jacket that probably cost $20. It's really interesting to see this
brilliant stuff. Yeah, yeah.
But I think that's just the Silicon Valley style. But more seriously, I think the conversation that was had between him and Nick Dirks, the Berkeley Chancellor, they did a sort of half-hour conversation. And one of the things that really struck me about the sort of LinkedIn idea, he's talking about ways that the degree will evolve and you'll start to unbundle things and LinkedIn data can start to inform where sort of skills gaps are and all that sort of stuff. But when it came back to the value of the degree and the value of critical thinking and all the rest of it, what was fascinating to him, you know, recall his degree, which was in, I think, philosophical logic at Oxford and Stanford. So, you know, that basis of universities and really broad-based education in really kind of, you know, serious academic disciplines remains a sort of bedrock, I think, even as we move into a world where, you know, the types of career that we go on to have and so on are quite different. So I think there was a lot of, I mean, that's, I think, ultimately why I feel quite optimistic about where universities go and their place in the world. Although I think Phil's absolutely right that it's all very well preaching to the choir at an event like this. It's more how do we get that out to the world at large.
And did we have any sense that, you know, beyond just restating the public good, there were any sort of solutions that were offered? I mean, Ellie, I know you were in sessions, there was a keynote there, which covered a lot of ground around the role that private universities could play, so not just public universities. Do you think there was any sense of solutions there, or indeed, you know, from other sessions?
Yeah, so I think Mary Sue Coleman from the Association of American Universities, and she was speaking about how, yeah, basically private universities can really prove that they're for the public good as well. And she suggested that they could double their enrolment of low-income students. It was actually in answer to a question about there's a new Stanford president and kind of what would she like him to sort of implement at the university. So it shouldn't just be down to kind of public universities to fulfil that role. But I thought it was also interesting that there were viewpoints from universities in other countries where actually the public is still behind higher education. So, you know, in Germany, they don't have any tuition fees, and at the moment, sort of taxpayers do seem to sort of be behind sort of investing in higher education, and the same in China. So that was sort of that also, I think, provided quite an optimistic view. Not that necessarily the US is going to kind of go back that way, but it's not completely global.
I mean, that's a really, the Germany case study is fascinating, isn't it? Because Bernd Huber, who's the president of LMU, was raising an issue that we've written about before in Times High. We had a cover feature probably last year by Howard Hodgson, Oxford, looking in specifics at the German situation, where they introduced these tuition fees, which actually weren't that high in comparison with, for example, UK or US, but they introduced them nonetheless, and essentially had, you know, sort of people's revolt, really, you know, the sort of politically it was so unpalatable that one by one the different states in Germany repealed it. And he was making the point that he can't see in the next decade at least politicians going anywhere near this again. So although, as Phil said earlier, there was a feeling that there are no votes in higher education in terms of, you know, politicians making higher education really high on their agenda during sort of election cycles, it appears that there is strong feeling amongst, you know, populations about things like tuition fees that can actually force change, which is quite an interesting idea when you're based somewhere like the UK, as we are, where you know, it feels as though tuition fees is a kind of line that's been crossed, you know, genie that's out of the bottle and is never going to be put back in.
But it's interesting though that Times Higher Education ran a piece from Andrea Schleicher at the OECD saying, oh, so the general public in Germany won't allow tuition fees politically, but Germany's universities are now suffering this erosion of the unit of funding because they've been, the population of university students is growing and they can't keep pace, so the public purse isn't able to absorb the growth. So there's a challenge now that do Germany's universities decline, do they accept that decline, or do they obviously differentiate more through the Excellence Initiative to make sure they stay competitive? So there's some real pressures. Of course, in South Africa, there's been a bit of a shutdown on overfees. Some of the students are...
Yeah, the question of whether this academic year is even going to get underway. And there you've got a state which really isn't capable of stepping in to fund the higher education system and indeed student finance in the way it's needed. So, yeah, clearly a global problem. Something wasn't just about funding, though. We were talking about sort of the whole range of university activities, also covering teaching, research, knowledge transfer. Just wondered whether there were any other sessions that particularly stood out of interest.
I mean, my personal favourite, and it was a huge personal highlight for me, was I got to interview Saul Perlmutter, the 2011 Nobel Prize winner for physics. And he was an extraordinary warm and energetic character. I've met a few Nobel Prize winners who aren't quite as accessible.
He's still teaching.
That was one of the amazing things. He was spoke with real passion about his commitment to undergraduate teaching, and he really does. He doesn't just rock up for a freshers' week opening lecture to get them all excited. He actually teaches and designs a course, and he's very interested in instilling those critical thinking skills into the undergraduate curriculum using a sort of research-led problem-solving approach. And I think that's really important, and it came out as a theme in the summit. You know, we had a lot of people, including the VC of University of Cambridge, really pushing back at this famous phrase from Michael Gove during the Brexit debate in Britain about, oh, we're sick of experts. Mm-hmm. This huge reassertion of the need for expertise, the need for critical thinking, the need for young people to actually critically analyse the information they're being seen. Of course, the presidential debate between Trump and Hillary Clinton was taking place during that week, and again, the focus on educating people for a healthy democracy was a massively important thing.
Never more important. John, I know you were also quite taken with some of the comments made by Michael Crow, the president of Arizona State. And I mean, that came part of a debate really about how technology could reshape the university and how teaching might change in the 21st century.
Yeah, well, he was very robust, wasn't he, in his defence of the university. We inevitably, I suppose, in California, on the stone's throw from Silicon Valley, we had various sort of tech evangelists turning up saying that the degree was dead, the university was dead. It was all going to be about using sort of social media data to sort of, you know, identify skills gaps and then delivering kind of bespoke, you know, in-house training almost for companies in that way. And although I'm sure there's something in that, in the sort of changing career paths and the changes required in sort of lifelong learning, if you like, there was also, you know, a feeling, certainly for journalists like us that cover higher education, that this tech stuff can sometimes be slightly overblown, and probably the hype around MOOCs illustrated that most vividly. But yeah, Michael Crow wasn't having much truck with it, was he? So he came on in a session and said, yeah, all these tech experts that keep turning up and telling us that the university is dead, they haven't got a clue what they're talking about. And I think that's pretty much a verbatim quote.
Yeah.
And he also pointed out that in many cases they also have a vested financial interest in whatever particular sort of tech savvy, tech heavy future they identify. I mean, he wasn't being a Luddite at all. Michael Crow is one of the most tech-savvy, you know, advanced vice-chancellors or presidents that there is in terms of using this stuff in an innovative way and in delivering degrees within a very large public university in America. So, you know, he was talking from a position of some authority on that, I think.
Yeah, no, I'm sure it's a view shared by many people in the room. Phil, the event was also marking the launch of Times Higher Education's first US college ranking in partnership with the Wall Street Journal. That's attracted lots of interest since it was launched. Perhaps you could just tell us a little bit about the launch and why it's different from the rankings which we've traditionally seen in the US.
Yeah, I mean, it was a really exciting moment for us, actually. Obviously, we've been publishing the world rankings for well over a decade, and they're very much the research-led elite, the globally focused universities with a heavy emphasis on research, although we do, you know, cover the teaching environment. This was a really big new step for Times Higher Education. It was the first ranking that was entirely focused on teaching excellence, entirely focused on the student. And we think we need to do this at the domestic level first, so we chose America. There was some fantastically rich data available, but we'd like to roll this out. We'd like to develop teaching-focused rankings to complement the research-led world rankings. So this was based on a survey of 100,000 US students that Times Higher Education commissioned, an engagement survey, so very much asking the right questions, not about satisfaction, but about, you know, how much you stretched and challenged, how much you've given access and content with your tutors, and all those sorts of key engagement questions. And we combine that with outcomes metrics. Are you getting jobs? Are you graduating on time? Are you paying back your debt? Massively important in the US at the moment, when there's $1.3 trillion dollars of student debt. And then we mix that up with some resources and some diversity metrics, really interesting metrics around inclusion, first generation students, about the diversity on campus. And I think the reason why we thought it was really exciting for the US is there's a very dominant US ranking that's sort of a market leader that's been around since the 80s, US News and World Report. And it gets heavily criticised for majoring on selectivity. How hard is it to get in? How many students do you reject?
Lots of inputs, basically.
Yeah, and we just felt we've added something really valuable to the picture there in terms of looking at outputs and student engagement and rejecting things like selectivity. So we're really excited. We think it's a bit of a game changer in the US. It got huge attention, lots of positive comment, and we'd love to start developing that for the rest of the world as well in due course.
Great, and the conversation doesn't stop here. We've also announced that next year, some of the 2017 World Academic Summit is going to be held at King's College London. I mean, that's going to be a fascinating discussion to bring the summit to Europe for the first time.
Yeah, we've already confirmed our Nobel laureate. We always seem to have at least one Nobel laureate at each event. So Paul Nurse from the Crick has agreed to speak. I've just had confirmation hot off the press that Louise Richardson from the University of Oxford will be joining us for that event. So we're really excited. The theme is around collaboration and partnership. I think, you know, London is a truly global city. There's a very strong emphasis on emphasising to the world that London is still open, despite all the messages we keep sending to the rest of the world. And I think, John, you were there at the launch, weren't you, of King's, the partnership King's announced recently, which is very much key to their sort of thinking about how differentiating in terms of the people you partner with, the universities you partner with, is a really interesting way forward for research universities.
Yeah, I mean, King's have partnered, well, it's an interesting one because they've partnered with the University of New South Wales and the University of Arizona, which of course is headed up by Michael Crowe, who we mentioned earlier, and that sort of three-way partnership, it's not necessarily three, you know, sort of identikit institutions that all come to the table with very similar strengths. You know, there's quite distinct areas of focus and you know, some quite novel aspects of each institution, and of course they're on the three, you know, arguably the three most prestigious developed higher education systems of Australia, US, UK. So a fascinating partnership that, and one that no doubt we'll discuss at the event next year.
Great. Well, sadly that's all we've got time for. There'll be all the coverage from the World Academic Summit, this year's summit that is, at www.timeshighereducation.com. There'll be full coverage as well in the 6th October issue of Times Higher Education, and plenty more to come as well. Online we'll have video interviews, footage of the sessions, and plenty of interviews too. If you'd like to join the conversation, the best place is through social media. You can use the hashtag THEWAS to join the conversation. But thanks for now, and we'll join you again next time.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.